This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. While most of the international attention these days has been on the Middle East and the crisis in Iraq, talks are underway this week in Beijing to deal with North Korea and its nuclear weapons capacity. 20 months ago, when the Bush administration was preparing to invade Iraq, North Korea pulled out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, expelled weapons inspectors, and appeared to be restarting its nuclear weapons program. Today, the Bush administration said it plans to offer a proposal to resolve the crisis. This is the third round of senior-level talks between the two Koreas, the U.S., Japan, Russia, and China. The two previous rounds ended inconclusively. My guest, Jack Pritchard, worked in both the Clinton and Bush administrations as an expert on North Korea, participating in negotiations with North Korea. He resigned from the Bush administration last August and subsequently began to make public his disagreements with the administration's policy toward North Korea. Pritchard is now a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. I asked him to explain the Bush administration's new proposal to North Korea.
Well, according to what we've seen in the newspapers and what's being reported on the wires, is that the United States has been authorized to show some degree of flexibility and provide an offer that would perhaps be a provisional security guarantee and then allowing others to provide energy assistance to North Korea if, and this is the conditionality, if North Korea commits to dismantling its plutonium and highly enriched uranium nuclear weapons programs. That's the gist of what the offer appears to be.
The Bush administration in the past has said it didn't want to offer incentives to North Korea for its bad behavior. It didn't want to offer incentives for dismantling the nuclear program because the program shouldn't have been there in the first place. Is this a change of policy, and what does it represent?
Well, it is a slight change. The mantra has always been, oh, we will not reward bad behavior. They should never have not done this to begin with. But what you're seeing now is a degree of flexibility aimed not towards North Korea, but towards China, South Korea, and to a limited extent Japan, allowing the talks to go beyond where we currently are. Because up to now, we're at an impasse with the United States consistently repeating CVID, complete, verifiable, irreversible dismantling, with no apparent success.
Now, before this latest development, the conventional wisdom was North Korea was unlikely to agree to anything before the presidential election because they want to see what the new administration will be. Do you think that that still will be true?
No, I do. I think key to this headline development, if you will, is the conditionality here where the United States is calling upon North Korea to commit to dismantle all of its nuclear weapons programs, specifically their plutonium and highly enriched uranium. That's the key. In a normal negotiations, if you were able to agree that the North Koreans could simply say, we agree to get rid of all of our nuclear weapons without having to specify the HEU, which they've denied up to this point, you might have some wiggle room for negotiations. But I absolutely believe that the instructions that the United States has is the North Koreans must commit specifically to getting rid of the HEU. That's been the stumbling block up to now, and it's highly unlikely, in my opinion, that the North Koreans at this round are going to suddenly say, well, yes, we do have HEU, and we will commit to getting rid of it.
So, in other words, they can't commit to get rid of it until they admit that they have it, and they're not ready to admit that.
Right. So what you end up having here is what appears to be a good deal of flexibility, and it is a movement in the right direction, but nonetheless, the conditionality and the specificity of having to acknowledge the HEU up front really is probably going to preclude the North Koreans at this point from agreeing in this round of talks.
So how would you sum up these developments in negotiations with North Korea?
The headline here is U.S. has new proposal, shows flexibility. That's great. It makes the process go another day. But at the end of this session, it's unlikely because of the split in the administration. They're going to be unwilling to accept a generic, we will dismantle all of our nuclear program. The elements in the Bush administration are going to demand that the North Koreans specify the highly enriched uranium program, and the North Koreans aren't going to do it this round.
What do you know about North Korea's nuclear capabilities right now? To our best knowledge, what are they?
Well, there's two two parts of that. What do we do know and what is a probable conjecture? The conjecture part is they may have as many as 8 nuclear weapons. What we know specifically is that there's an amount of plutonium that is unaccounted for prior to the original 1994 agreed framework. Most intelligence analysts believe that is about enough for 1 or 2 nuclear weapons. So set that aside for just a second. And then the North Koreans most recently, beginning in January 2003, began a process of reprocessing their spent fuel that they had under essentially international lock and key until the end of December 2002. Over a 6-month period beginning in January 2003, they reprocessed this, extracted the plutonium, and by most estimates, there's enough there for another 6 weapons. We don't know for sure if they've actually made the weapons or what they've done with the plutonium, but a prudent guess would be that they have at least the ability to have made a total of 8 nuclear weapons.
What about biological and chemical weapons?
Well, you know, that doesn't come to the forefront, but we've known for many years that they've got a stockpile, certainly of chemical weapons. The South Koreans each year estimate how much that is. We believe they have a biological program as well. That's not what's in the news, but they certainly do have that capability, and you have to take a look at it as part of their overall WMD program.
So the state of our relationship with North Korea now and the state of North Korea's weapons program is that they're out of the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. They pulled out of that. They're processing plutonium again, and for all we know, they're building nuclear weapons now. And we're not negotiating with them directly. We're only negotiating with them in these 6-party talks.
That's correct. In January 2003, the North Koreans announced their withdrawal from the NPT, the non-proliferation treaty. Some will argue that they didn't actually have that right to do it, but nonetheless, they've done it, and the end result is there are not any inspectors present, nor are they, from a North Korean point of view, bound to any of the obligations of the NPT. They have completed, according to them, the reprocessing of these 8,017 spent fuel rods. So theoretically, they have the capability to add another 6 nuclear weapons to their potential arsenal of 1 or 2 that they already have. And yes, we are not talking to them directly, as all of the other members of the 6 parties have urged the United States to do. But this administration has relied exclusively on the multilateral tract over the last almost 2 years.
Why does the Bush administration not want to have one-on-one talks with North Korea?
I think it is a basic problem that this situation, as it began to unfold in October of 2002, when Assistant Secretary Jim Kelly and myself and a few others went to Pyongyang to confront North Korea over what we believe to be their highly enriched uranium program, a distinction from the plutonium program that we were aware of, that that as the North Koreans began to say, we'll only talk to you, the United States, and they began to withdraw from the NPT, kick out the IAEA inspectors, it looked remarkably similar to the situation in 1993 and the results thereof, which was the 1994 agreed framework that the Clinton administration negotiated, for which current Bush administration and most those who are opposed to the agreed framework, they were very concerned that it would end up very similar to that. So they wanted to have a multilateral approach to resolving the problem. And quite frankly, that's the appropriate thing to do in terms of bringing in all of the regional players involved. But it is not the only thing that should be done. It should not be exclusive. And the reason we've made no progress over almost 2 years is because we've had no direct contacts in a serious manner with them.
So you think that there should be breakaway talks where the United States talks one-on-one with North Korea, in addition to the six-party talks?
Yes, complementary. You know, you have to take a look at this, that all the other parties involved are having bilateral talks with the North Koreans and among themselves. We are exclusively not doing that. You know, you need really to have a synergistic effect of a direct dialogue with the North Koreans, comparing that to the dialogue that they're having with the Japanese and the South Koreans, and then bringing the results into the six-party process to make the most progress that you can. You know, I'll give you another, if I may, another example here. The North Koreans are extraordinarily unlikely to admit to having violated the 1994 agreed framework by secretly starting up an HEU, highly enriched uranium program. That's what the Bush administration wants the North Koreans to do. They're not going to do that in the front of, in front of others. They've been denying it all along. But in a bilateral, serious discussion with the United States, you may find a way to get that kind of information into the dialogue, find out where it belongs, and then at an appropriate point bring it into the six party dialogue. The North Koreans simply are not going to stand up in a what they see as a an international court of law and admit to their violations.
What are the Bush administration criticisms of the agreement with North Korea that was reached in 1994 during the Clinton administration?
Well, the primary one is that it postponed some of our most serious nonproliferation concerns, and it allowed the North Koreans technically to be in violation of their NPT obligations. Those are both true. The first one is the more specific and more serious of that. The 1994 agreed framework did not remove the spent fuel that had been used in the nuclear reactors. That's the material that you can then reprocess and extract plutonium from and then build nuclear weapons. It postponed the removal out of North Korea until the first light water reactor was built and turned over to the North Koreans. In that period of time, just before nuclear technology should be transferred or key components transferred to the North Koreans and the completion of the first LWR, that's when the spent fuel rods should have been removed from North Korea. Now, what that did by this postponement was leave in place in North Korea these spent fuel rods that if the North Koreans ever broke their pledge and decided to reprocess them, they'd have on, in their hands the capability to create nuclear weapons. That's precisely what has occurred. It's a legitimate criticism, but it was within the context of the negotiations in 1994, something that could not have been avoided according to those that were most intimately involved in the negotiations.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jack Pritchard, and he's now a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. He worked in both the Clinton and Bush administrations as an expert on North Korea and was involved in negotiations with North Korea in both administrations. When President Bush made his State of the Union address, in which he described North Korea as being part of the axis of evil, were you consulted on that? Were you consulted about whether you thought, as a North Korea expert, that that was a good idea?
No one was consulted on that. My understanding is the Secretary of State may have seen that particular passage shortly before the speech was given, but it was not circulated among any of the experts, and it came as a surprise to us within government as well as to the rest of the world.
Had you been consulted about it, what would you have said?
One, you end up being in an awkward situation of not wanting to defend North Korea. It is certainly a dictatorial regime. There are very few good qualities about it. But the accuracy and the lumping of it as part of the axis of evil with Iraq, for which the North Koreans and others very well knew the position of the United States and watched it unfold in terms of the military confrontation that was taking place, and the fact that there was no linkage between the two, and in fact the three, Iran being the third element of the axis of evil, it really was disturbing to most the nations of the world, a kind of gratuitous lumping of North Korea in this very catchy and certainly often repeated phrase of axis of evil. It has not served our purpose very well.
What effect do you think it has had on the leadership of North Korea?
Well, it's served a couple things. First and foremost, though, it has scared them. As they watched the U.S. Actions towards Iraq, time and again they would say, we're very concerned that we're next, that we're part of your hit list, that once you have accomplished what you wanted to do in Iraq, you're going to turn in the same manner towards us. So they began to withdraw and, quite frankly, use that as a pretext to then reprocess the spent fuel, first telling us that it was designed for peaceful means, that they simply were trying to keep it safeguarded. But once they saw the outbreak of hostilities in March of 2003, they came back to me and said, we're changing our rationale. If Iraq, that did not have weapons of mass destruction is attacked, then we'll be next. So our defense will be to develop nuclear weapons of our own. So we're going to do that for a deterrent purpose. Now, I don't buy any of that, but that's what they've said.
After the axis of evil reference in the State of the Union address, did you or any of the other North Korea experts talk to the president and tell him that you thought that that was a mistake?
I certainly did not. I don't know if Secretary Powell. It was certainly too soon. What followed the following month, you may recall, is the president's trip to South Korea, his first trip, first and only trip to South Korea. The damage that it had done there, the South Koreans at that point, primarily because of the axis of evil speech, among other things, were very concerned, and the talk in the street was the possibility of war on the peninsula. So the president's trip, he did a lot of damage control to get the alliance back into shape. Based upon the concerns that the South Koreans had over his use of the axis of evil terminology.
Were there strong divisions within the Bush administration about how to proceed with North Korea after that State of the Union address?
There have always been, from day one, very strong differences within the Bush administration. It wasn't just after the axis of evil speech. At the beginning of the administration, when they undertook a policy review, the split within the administration was as wide as I've seen it on any issue, and it continues to this day.
Who was on which side?
Well, you had a basic lineup of almost the entire Pentagon was advocating don't deal with North Korea, hard line towards North Korea. You had an element within the State Department headed by Undersecretary John Bolton who also advocated that. You had a sizable element within the White House led by the Senior Director for Counterproliferation, Bob Joseph, and elements of the Vice President's office as well. Counterbalanced against that, you had part of the National Security Council in the form of the Asian Directorate, along with most of the State Department advocating a more moderate approach to solving the problem.
So is it fair to say that the people in the Bush administration who were strongest in their insistence that we needed to invade Iraq, the same people who were strongest in their insistence that we should not talk directly with North Korea?
One and the same.
And how do those two positions connect?
Well, I don't know if they do connect, other than the philosophy that has guided us in our actions in Iraq and has precluded any meaningful resolution of the problem that we have in North Korea. Very hard-line ideological viewpoint. These are positions that are very firmly believed in and held, and they vigorously fight any opposition to those.
Some people did wonder, why are we invading Iraq when we don't really know for sure if they have weapons of mass destruction, and it turns out none have been found yet, when in North Korea we can be pretty confident that even if they don't have nuclear weapons, they're awfully close to having them, and they do have according to what you said, chemical and biological weapons already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the rationale doesn't hold up. You essentially had an administration in October of 2002 when we confronted the North Koreans in Pyongyang about their highly enriched uranium program, for which we believed that they admitted to that program. You had a North Korea in violation of their obligations under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, essentially saying, yes, we have nuclear weapons. Yes, we have the technology. And the Bush administration is saying, put that on the back burner. Don't let that become a crisis. I'm more concerned about what Iraq has, and we'll deal with North Korea later. And what we found out is that Iraq didn't have the weapons of mass destruction, and the North Koreans not only did, but during this time frame increased their stockpile fourfold.
Do you think that part of the issue here is that it was very difficult to handle two international crises at the same time?
Well, not only was it difficult, it was a very specific decision made by President Bush that what was occurring in Asia would not become a crisis. That was very clear. It was clearly communicated to the Secretary of State and through him to the rest of us that were working on Korea that nothing North Korea could do would cause the President to treat this as a crisis. Now, that was borne by the taboo of the language. Whenever reporting described it as a crisis, the administration would say, no, it's not a crisis. It takes two to have a crisis, and this is not a crisis.
And what was your reaction to that approach?
Well, I began to question whether or not we had a policy in place that was going to address this most serious concern that was developing in North Korea. So I was beginning to have very much concerned about how this was playing out.
And what you're referring to, this is the period when North Korea pulled out of the Nonproliferation Treaty and when weapons inspectors were expelled from the country.
That's correct. Now, this all happened in very rapid fashion. You may recall it was the beginning of October 2002 that we went to Pyongyang, talked to the North Koreans, told them that we believed that they had a secret nuclear program based on HEU. Thereafter, the North Koreans in December kicked out the IAEA inspectors. They took off the locking mechanisms. They turned off the cameras. And then in January, pulled out of the NPT and then began to reprocess the spent fuel that heretofore had been frozen and under international inspection.
What do you think would have been an alternate way of addressing what the North Koreans had done on the eve of the invasion of Iraq?
Well, it is not as simple as saying here are the things that should have occurred at that point. Actually, we need to go back more than a year in terms of how we were developing our relationship with our allied partners, the Republic of Korea, South Korea. You may recall in March of 2001 when former South Korean President Kim Dae-jung visited Washington, he did not receive a very cordial welcome. In fact, he was extremely embarrassed over his treatment. So our relationship with South Korea was very strained early on. Now, what that translates into is any ability to use all our diplomatic tools, which would have included the ability to take the problem to the United Nations to seek sanctions of any kind, absolutely required the cooperation and full support of South Korea. We eliminated early on that possibility by alienating our South Korean ally. But assuming that we had that in place, we could have, through a direct contact, once we had put in place the multilateral process, the six-party process, begun to move much faster in dealing with North Korea. One of the things that should have been done early on was to declare a red line to the North Koreans, let them know, as the Clinton administration did, that reprocessing of the spent fuel, which would have resulted in the extraction of plutonium and then the ability to create nuclear weapons, would not be tolerated at any cost, to include a possible confrontation with the United States and its allies. The Bush administration has not, in this current crisis beginning in October of 2002, put a red line down to tell the North Koreans any particular behavior is off limits. So the North Koreans have been probing and testing to find out just how far they can go. And as they did in January and through June of 2003, they reprocessed something that, according to Dr. Bill Perry, the former Secretary of Defense, in the 93-94 timeframe, would have led to war in the Clinton administration.
What would be your critique of how the Clinton administration addressed North Korea?
You know, that's a little tough because the most difficult period of the Clinton administration in terms of dealing with North Korea was in the 93-94 period, a year or so prior to when I joined the administration. I think the most difficult thing altogether was we had different timetables, the Clinton administration and the North Koreans. The North Koreans finally wised up towards the end and began to try to engage in a more serious manner with the Clinton administration, and time simply ran out. You know, the president couldn't do things that would commit a follow-on administration so late in the game. So it's difficult to give you a critique of the Clinton administration. It simply was a mismatch in time management between the United States and North Korea.
Now, you were in North Korea in January as part of a five-member unofficial delegation. What was this delegation for? Like, who organized it, and who did you represent?
Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't represent anyone but ourselves. This was organized by Professor John Lewis, Stanford. He had been going to North Korea very quietly since 1987. He made a number of trips there to have quiet conversations with the North Koreans. I don't know if they invited him or how this particular trip evolved, but as I left government in August of 2003, John, whom I've known, asked me to join so it would round out the number of people that he had and the expertise that we would take in there. Solely as an unofficial delegation. He added, which was extraordinarily smart on his part, the former director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, Dr. Sig Hecker, and then two other participants who were really traveling separately, two staffers for the Senate, Frank Januzzi and Keith Luce. So it's loosely referred to as a group of five, but more technically it may have been a group of three and a group of two that joined together to go to North Korea in early January of this year.
What was your purpose?
Well, one of the things that John Lewis wanted to do, and that I was anxious to do as well, was to talk to the North Koreans about what they had been doing at Yongbyon, the site of their nuclear facility, their plutonium-based nuclear facility. So we asked to go there. We asked to see what the status was. Up until that point, most of the intelligence reporting and other analysis suggested that the North Koreans may have started the reprocessing, but probably had not finished it, or some problem had occurred, and that the spent fuel was still in the spent fuel storage area. So we went. We asked to go. The North Koreans were actually very accommodating. Took us to Yongbyon, a couple-hour trip or so from Pyongyang to where they have a 5-megawatt nuclear reactor that also had been frozen until January of a year ago. We talked to the nuclear scientist there. We took a look at their facilities. We were not inspectors. We had not gone in any official capacity. We had no scientific equipment other than the brain power of Dr. Hecker with us. But we saw that their 5-megawatt nuclear reactor was up and operational. We talked to the scientists there. We went over to their spent fuel storage facility where these 8,000 some 17 spent fuel rods had been encased in canisters that had been built specially by the Department of Energy. Their spent fuel rods are put in these canisters. They're stored underwater in a pond. We went there. We saw for the most part that the canisters were empty. The North Koreans were anxious for us to then accept that they, in fact, now possessed a nuclear deterrent. We told them, no, we can't say that. We can only attest to what we have seen or what we have not seen. We told them that we had looked into the pond. We could see some of the canisters were empty, but other canisters still had lids on them, and we had no idea whether they were still possessed spent fuel or they were empty themselves. They then said, well, do you want to look in those as well? And we said, certainly. So the brave five of us sent Dr. Hecker back in rather than us. and he randomly chose canisters to take a look at. They opened them up, and they were empty. He spent a little bit more time than we did collectively looking at the pond and is convinced that there are no spent fuel rods remaining there. They're gone. That in itself was a piece of information, intelligence that we, the United States, had not known before. We took a look at their reprocessing facility, and we rely on Dr. Hecker as a nuclear scientist, a plutonium specialist, to tell us really what we're seeing. They could have shown us, a barn for all we knew collectively, and we would have nodded. But Dr. Hecker's specialty was able to look at the facilities, make judgments, talk to the scientists there. The North Koreans were very anxious after that to say, well, now do you believe that we have a nuclear deterrent? And we said, no, we can't say that. We haven't seen any of your reprocessed material. And I think, as you have probably seen in Dr. Hecker's public testimony, what occurred next was the North Koreans asked, well, would you like to see it? And, of course, we said yes. So we went into a very small side room, conference room, and they brought out a lead box, opened it up, and there were two wooden boxes inside. And when they opened those up, there was two jars, glass jars, one containing a powder substance and the other containing a metal substance. They told us that these were plutonium oxalate, a reprocessed form of plutonium, and plutonium metal. And according to Dr. Hecker, there's only one reason that you have plutonium metal, and that is to then form it into a nuclear weapon.
So did this leave you convinced that North Korea actually has a nuclear weapon now? That they've converted the spent plutonium rods and.
To be honest and careful here, we can only report specifically on what we saw. But
right.
the prudent person would not dismiss the probability that the North Koreans have done precisely what they've said. We've seen enough to suggest they had that capability. Whether or not they've actually done it or they're in the process, it's another case. I myself believe they probably have, but I don't know for certain.
So. There's a really interesting parallel going on here that I'd like to ask you about. You know, in Iraq, the weapon inspectors weren't finding anything. And before their inspections were finished, they had to pull out because of the U.S. plans to invade Iraq. So shortly after that, you go to North Korea. The North Koreans want you to come so that they could do their best to prove to you that they actually have nuclear weapons, that they are moving on in their nuclear program, and nothing happens with that.
It is very interesting. Now, for the North Koreans, it's very simple. Beginning really in March of 2003, they're extraordinarily concerned that they could be the target of the next military operation in the United States. So they're anxious to have a nuclear deterrent. But a nuclear deterrent or any kind of deterrent only works if the person that you are trying to deter believes you. And the reaction of the United States through 2003 was essentially, well, we really don't believe you. You may have started, but you haven't finished, so you probably don't have a nuclear deterrent. That bothered the North Koreans. So some would argue that we, this group of five, were being used by the North Koreans, but we made it very clear to them that we would not speculate on what they had. We would only report what we saw or didn't see. But you can understand their desire to get somebody there. If it hadn't been us, it probably would have been Congressman Kurt Weldon that they had been trying to get there prior to our visit that couldn't go or canceled his trip. But they wanted to show somebody something in which they then could declare as authoritatively as they could that they do have a nuclear deterrent, so back off, United States. So that was their motivation in showing us what they did show, to the extent that they did show us things.
Now, the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-il, is not considered the most reflective, rational, logical leader. I mean, some people would say you can't negotiate with somebody like that.
Yeah, it's very interesting in terms of people's perception of Kim Jong-il. Prior to about April of 2000, what you've just described was held widely by the United States, by South Korea, by Japan, by almost everyone, that Kim Jong-il was not a rational person, that he had presided over decisions to blow planes out of the sky, to bomb the cabinet of South Korea on a visit to Burma. But very strangely, and certainly in hindsight it's not so strange, but in around April of 2000, the South Koreans began to describe him as, well, maybe he is a rational character. Maybe he is a worldly leader. And that puzzled people until it became known that the South Koreans had begun to negotiate for their president to travel to Pyongyang to meet with Kim Jong-il. You know, and no country is going to want to send their president off to see an irrational dictator. So they had to rehabilitate his image in a kind of an open way. And since then, we've had snapshots of Kim Jong-il that we've never had before. We've had not only Kim Dae-jung, the president of South Korea's visit in the middle of June of 2000 there, and kind of the public images of someone that you could talk to and deal with. We had shortly thereafter a trip by former Secretary Albright in late October 2000, in which I accompanied her. We met with Kim Jong-il. Prime Minister Koizumi of Japan has now had two meetings with him, and others have as well. So his image is being rehabilitated one snapshot at a time.
What were your impressions of Kim Jong-il?
Well, he wanted to portray himself in a more worldly way, trying to convince us that he kept up with the world news. But it was my impression that he was far more informed on regional issues. And when he began to stray beyond Northeast Asia, it was clear that he really was not on top of those issues. But he does, by his own admission, he watches CNN. He watches Japanese and South Korean television. He reads the news. So he's probably the most informed person in North Korea, having access to outside media that others in his country do not have.
Did he strike you as a trustworthy, reliable negotiating partner, that if he agreed to something that he would follow through on that agreement?
Very hard to predict. They think the shorter answer is you can probably make a deal with him. Whether or not you trust him is an entirely different situation. You go back to the Ronald Reagan axiom, trust but verify.
You're concerned that we have not engaged in bilateral talks with North Korea, that we've kind of put North Korea on the back burner while dealing with Iraq. And in the meantime, North Korea has been pursuing its nuclear weapons program. What do you think, what do you fear the consequences might be a little further down the line?
Well, my fear is that we will lose whatever window of opportunity that we have to negotiate diplomatically a peaceful resolution to this situation. There may come a time when the North Koreans simply withdraw and then keep a permanent nuclear deterrent, in their words, and that may have consequences in Northeast Asia that we can't begin to imagine down the road, not immediately, but down the road as the Chinese are concerned how the Japanese react, et cetera. And first and foremost is we do not have their nuclear weapons material and technology under international control. We have no idea where it's going to end up in the years to come.
Jack Pritchard, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jack Pritchard worked in the Clinton and Bush administrations on North Korea. He resigned from the Clinton administration last August. He's now a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution.